So we are nearing the end here, and at the conclusion of this course, for the last three or four items that we're looking at, basically what I'm trying to offer you are contemporary examples of courage and freedom and being political outside of the pre-established Democratic or Democratic Party, Republican Party framework. I want to show you that real processes with real people that really could radically change the structures in which we live really do exist, and they exist pretty close by us, actually. It's not so much a question of, is our society inevitable? It's not inevitable, and it's in perpetual change and collapse and reconstruction at pretty much all times. Anyway, the idea that we have a stable capitalist state imperial regime with its racial dynamics and its class splits and all that, and that that is stable, and that that is something that we cannot really argue with, that idea is primarily and fundamentally an ideological idea. It has to be said because it's not really true. So the point of concluding with this series of references, and I'll list off the series in a second, is simply to provide models and proof. Models that show you what is possible, show you some things that are possible. And I think, I mean, I've selected these, of course, but I think there's a remarkable similarity between these instances that I'm giving you. There are models, and there are, I don't know, there's an incitement here. There's things that can be done, and there's starting points that are clear, and there are allies who, because these are contemporary processes, there are allies who can be reached out to. Now, the groups that I'm talking about, or the projects that I'm talking about today, are Cooperation Jackson, and more broadly, the Jackson-Cush Plan in Mississippi. Next, the Zapatistas, and we'll look specifically at their form of organizing and democracy. What is that? How could that be deployed by us? And recognize also that it's not just that in Chiapas and across Mexico increasingly, and especially in Oaxaca, forms of organization like the Zapatistas are still existing and still experimentally developing, but also that Zapatista-inspired forms of organizing are very close by us here, and we might have a chance even to speak with some people who have been involved in that form of organizing. Mississippi's not that far away. And then the other key example that I wanted to point at, well, two key examples, I guess, are indigenous organizing, particularly in Canada, the reading that we have, and then Kurdish organizing, particularly in Rojava. These are all contemporary processes. Notice that they are linked not in, they're not just reiterations, but they are permutations and they are relations to the traditions that we've been talking about, the indigenous tradition, the black liberation tradition, the anarcho-communist tradition, you know, solidarity unionism, and the sort of thing that Hannah Arendt talked about. These are still the forms that are in question now. Okay, so let's talk about Cooperation Jackson. We're reading, Kamau Franklin and Kale Akuno. Kale Akuno is the best known figure now associated with Cooperation Jackson, especially now that Chakwe Lumumba, who was elected mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, but didn't last very long. He had a heart attack, but maybe under somewhat suspicious circumstances. Kale Akuno is the person who is most prominently associated and seems, at least from my limited perspective, seems to be the person most interviewed. I know people who have brought him here to Los Angeles to talk. We could probably even reach out to him for a future semester if we wanted to have a conversation with him ourselves. These are real people who really exist, and they want support. and they want their forms of organizing and self-determination to be propagated. When we look at the Zapatista model, the education that Dylan Fitzwater received from the Zapatistas was offered as a seed. These are seeds. These are seeds that I'm giving you too. You know, they're starting points. I'm not laying out all the details of what can be done. I don't even know what you should do. But there are some seeds that if you consider them, you know, and you started to nurture them, they would grow in their own specific way in your particular context. So, okay, so Cooperation Jackson is one of those. It's a real thing that's happening. But our study of it, our integration with it, our concern with it has the quality of a seed. You know, if you start to take things seriously, if you start to really recognize, look, there are possibilities, it's a matter of organizing. It's a matter of how you use your time. It's a matter of your real decisions. And those decisions need to be made in a framework where your imagination is broadened past what you've always been told is all that is possible. Okay, so the starting point for Cooperation Jackson, a quick historical starting point, is from the 1960s. It's the Malcolm X grassroots movement still that is the name of the organizing body primarily responsible for organizing in Jackson. This whole movement takes its origins from Malcolm X and begins with the 1968 Republic of New Africa, whose goal was to establish a large section of actually independent, sovereign black territory in the South. By the 1980s, this became the New Africa People's Organization. And then one of these guys, Okuno, I think, tells us in 2006 to 2008 is the real starting point for the larger scale people's assemblies that now still exist in Jackson. And this was in response to Katrina. The Jackson People's Assembly was a popular organizing drive and a political movement, basically a getting together of people to try and decide on a popular basis how to deal with the fairly extensive damage that was done by that hurricane. So that's the historical genesis. Now, the theoretical backdrop here should now be familiar to us. It is that the political situation in Jackson, Mississippi was peculiar in one way, but problematic and predictable in a second. The peculiarity is that this is a dominantly black region. So here's a territory where most of the candidates in the 1980s, 1990s, 2000s, most of the candidates for especially the Democratic Party were already black. So it might appear that this is a place where black power in some form would already exist. You have black representatives. Don't they therefore necessarily speak for you if you are a black person? And the answer, of course, is no, they don't. And Malcolm X had pointed this out. So this is the familiar starting point. What exists in Jackson, except insofar as Cooperation Jackson is being successful, is a neo-colonial situation where you have black faces who look familiar and therefore in a sort of superficial way trustworthy to a black electorate, but who in reality are totally subsumed within and dependent upon for their funding, for their continued power, for people working with them on the Democratic Party, which is a white dominated party. And the way that our writers today put this, those black leaders couldn't not appear to be too black and to be too concerned with the conditions of specifically black people, lest they lose the backing of their white bosses. So there does exist a nominally democratic structure, but it's not really democratic. There does exist a nominally black structure, but it's not really black. There does exist a vehicle for the expression of the popular will, but it doesn't actually really do that. What it does is to integrate all of those things, to integrate that population, to integrate their need for expression, for self-determination, just far enough to neutralize them. That is a neo-colonial structure, and its real function is to allow large-scale external interests, corporations, to access local resources, and among these resources, central among these resources, to access and exploit local labor. So this is in conflict with a desire for freedom. Here, freedom again is understood as self-determination, and self-determination at, here there's not much discussion of the cultural scale like we've heard before, but especially at the political and the economic levels. Self-determination is the necessity. Self-determination is the goal. It is what is being insisted upon by this lineage of black organizations, black power organizations. And Cooperation Jackson is a way to go about achieving that. Okay, so what can be done? Let's say that there are these two levels. There's the political level, and there's the economic level. I'll start with the political level. The simple answer of what can be done is the formation of people's assemblies. Now, this requires a whole lot of preliminary organization, especially because they feel that a people's assembly is not legitimate or dependable or significant until it hits a certain mass, until, according to their somewhat arbitrary figure, but rule of thumb, that an assembly ought to represent, at least it ought to include, physically, directly include, we're talking about direct democracy here, it ought to physically include at least one-fifth of the people at a particular place in a particular neighborhood, wherever the assembly is called. So the claim is, and I think this is something that we'll see through the rest of our reading as well, that people's assemblies are a widespread and dependable way to attempt to restore direct democracy and self-determination in places where those have been colonially erased and supplanted, replaced with something that is called democracy, but is definitely not direct and is arguably not democracy. So they reference Latin America and then later, more specifically, Venezuela, and then give us a longer list of places in I suppose, in the past 10, 15 years, where popular assemblies have been an important phenomenon: Nepal, Greece, Spain, Tunisia, Egypt, Burkina Faso. We could add to that Bolivia, Chile. People's assemblies means the getting together of people. And then you'll see the same thing if you look at Fitzwater. Of course, this is just a starting point. And then a whole bunch of political, governmental, organizational complexities present themselves. So in this case, they develop a people's task force, which sounds like a fancy name for the group of organizers that are getting all this stuff together. But ideally, the people's assemblies choose their own task force, which, you know, in a kind of standard organizing format, I'm thinking this is kind of like a steering committee, right? The people who do more regular work outside the meeting itself in order to make the meeting possible, and then move to implement the decisions taken by a people's assembly. So a large-scale assembly requires or generates a smaller operating body, which ought to be entirely responsible to and recallable by that people's assembly. And then this people's task force, its basic job is to set up and telegraph an agenda from the people's assembly to a bunch of committees. And the committees then carry out the decisions that are made by the people's assembly. So basically, this is a process of establishing direct democracy outside the confines of the existing official political machinery. And they give us a few more details about what types of assemblies there are: the United Front, the Constituent Assembly, the Mass Assembly. You can check out those things if you want. But the overall picture that is being drawn here is a picture for the generation of dual power. This is a contemporary goal that exists in a whole lot of places. It exists in Rojava, exists in some way in Chiapas, but it existed in Occupy. It probably even exists well, in contemporary ways today in Chile and Bolivia, dual power. I mean, dual power, you could even look at like the Iroquois constitution, and you'll see an actually formalized system of dual power. Dual power means that there is on the one hand a formal and maybe sort of state-like government, but on the other hand, there is a direct democratic popular political movement with its own structures, its own meetings, its own decision-making capacity, which counterbalances and could even undermine the first official state-related political apparatus. The general strategy here is to develop popular democracy as a substitute, a growing substitute for the domination of state politics, which, you know, according to Uchilan, who we'll get to eventually, you know, state politics is the same thing as the absence of politics. Meaning that we think that we take part in our democracy, but all that means is that we like vote once in a great while. We don't know how to get together. We don't know how to listen to one another. We don't know how to raise an issue. We don't know how to run a good meeting that is clear about what questions need to be discussed, that is capable of moving to a decision and then enacting that decision. We can know those things, and we must learn those things, but we don't generally have those skills because we have been denied them. So insofar as we have these state political party machines going on, we have the semblance of politics, but no real politics at all. The dual power idea is let's build real politics. Let's build real democracy by taking our time and our space to do so. And what are we trying to do? We're trying to get a whole bunch of people who are impacted by some issues to get together to talk about those issues. And notice, there is this question of campaign-oriented or longer-term organization-oriented organizing. Do we get people together only to talk about one thing, and if that one thing is dealt with, we let that organizing fall apart? Or do we understand that our work is basically there to establish political structures, to establish, like in the Zapatista case, experimental political practices? And by experimental, I mean subject to change on the basis of the decisions and experiences of those who have participated. So the structure of governance in Chiapas is much different now than it was in 25 years ago when it first became public, because they saw problems and they fixed them. They saw challenges and they figured out ways to organize themselves to meet those challenges. The same thing is true about Cooperation Jackson. So the dual power, meaning that you're trying to build popular power in an organized sense, you're trying to organize the population in a direct democratic way with an economic footing, which I'll come to next, in order to offset, to supplant the existing structures of externally determined governance. The neocolonial structures. We want to push those back by putting something in their place. I think very roughly speaking, this idea of substituting through hardcore grassroots organizing is also largely what a lot of people mean when they use the term abolition. So the key things that need to be done, the general things that need to be done, are to politicize people in general, which means to get them involved in talking about their real situation in a clear-headed way, hearing one another about their situation, evaluating their interest in that situation, really beginning to understand or talk through possibilities for altering that situation, and then taking steps to actually do so. That's politicization, right? That's what Cooperation Jackson is all about. That's what the Zapatistas are about. That's what Rojava is about. That seems to be what a lot of indigenous organizing requires, is politicization, and especially the politicization of younger people. And then as a basic rule of like, you know, what is it that we're attempting to do at the beginning stages? We're trying to build spaces. We're trying to create spaces where discussions and self-determination can begin to happen. So the role of early organizers is this politicization and space making, which I think is something worth spending our time on. Now, there's this political dimension, and there's also an economic dimension to cooperation, Jackson. So, you know, you can check out the book that I used, which is called Jackson Rising. It has a whole bunch of different presentations of the projects that have been dreamt or begun or brought to some completion in Jackson. That book is maybe 5 years old, so there are things that have happened since then. But this movement still exists. The last I checked in on them, they had used a bunch of their land trust facilities in order to begin making masks. So there's an economic dimension. So they want popular, direct democracy on an assembly basis. And then they want what they would call a solidarity economy, meaning the manufacture and trade of goods for the purpose of sustaining the community for itself, in order to sustain itself, not for the sake primarily of profit, although I think some of the business endeavors, the cooperative business endeavors that they have gestated do operate for profit, but then that profit is shared within the community. It's not individual profit. So here are some of the projects. There's participatory budgeting, which I think is a technique used in a lot of different places, which means that through this popular assembly process, you get the general population to think about how much money there is, what needs there are, and you get a popular reading on what do they think ought to be done with that money. If you do those sorts of things in a school, for example, you will get radically different views from the majority of us, the students and lecturers and staff, who suffer through these environments, and the actual allocations, which of course are super top heavy. The same thing is true for a city. The same thing is true on a national basis. If we were capable of that kind of survey of the general American populace, you would never end up with the kind of military spending or corporate handouts that really exist in the United States budget. The budgets that we have are not in our interests. So participatory budgeting is an important practice. An education project, and they list off 20 different focuses of such an educational project. They want to build their own schools, build their own educational programs for themselves, by themselves, on the basis of their capacities, oriented towards their needs. Community credit union, community gardens, a broader vision of a network of agricultural cooperatives. So farms, farmers markets, stores that are run by people. And they indeed have started cooperative businesses on the basis of land trusts, right? So they're pooling money and taking donated money in order to buy property in Jackson and then using that property not on an individual but on a communal basis. So you have a shared wood shop, for example, where different people who might have the capacity to build things but don't have the capital, the space, and the tools that are necessary to build things, now they can do that. And they can work together in order to generate money or to fulfill the housing needs, for example, of the community itself. The attempt in general is to harness and organize, to harness by organizing the labor and thought and decision-making of the general population for the sake of that population. So they're building their own recreational spaces. They're building these business cooperatives. They're trying to establish networks of neighborhood barter so that, you know, like things like time banking, where people put in a certain amount and they say, okay, I have this skill. I'm an accountant. I can help you deal with your business questions, and I can help you deal with your taxes. But somebody else can say, "Oh, I'm a plumber, and I have been doing this for a long time, and I can solve most plumbing problems." Those people with very different skills can share with one another, and we can start to reestablish community functions independent of profit making and money. And then maybe the last thing to say is that, you know, the political process is a dual power process, and they have this in mind. So on the one hand, they're trying to use the assemblies and the committees in order to orient people towards especially these economic processes, to improve their physical circumstance and to use the political apparatus as a way to organize that improvement. But they also know that they exist under a state administration, and another government, which is the city council, mayorship structure of the city. So they're also trying to field representatives, council members. And eventually they succeeded in electing the mayor. And they think, at least, that they can pick people from their own ranks who they already trust and give those people an agenda. Instead of the candidate setting up an agenda or a campaign around a few key issues that can raise passions enough to vote, instead they want the popular assembly to be fundamental, the representative to be secondary and to be selected from that popular assembly and to be guided by that popular assembly. They understood Chakwe Lumumba. And I think eventually his son also becomes mayor after his passing. These individuals are people who have been with this movement for a long time, and they trust them to advance an agenda which is not their own, but which is that of the assembly, which is that of the popular direct democracy, which is growing within Jackson. And then they can operate within the state dimension of the political apparatus in order to push for things like, well, in general, to push to restore the commons is how they put it. That should be familiar language, to push for universal health care, to push for dependable pensions for everybody, better child care for everyone, better transportation, and so on. So this is one example of things that really exist in the world that I think are pretty cool, that are anti-colonial, that are directly democratic, that aim at dual power, and that through dual power attempts to, you know, carry out a kind of revolutionary movement by substitution and undermining.